This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Rene Orang at Visit Baton Rouge, and we'll get a recap of the year that was in 2013 in our city as far as visitors coming to our community, and look ahead to 2014. What can we anticipate in the year to come? Also, Ilyasa Shabazz, the daughter of Malcolm X, one of his six daughters. She's written a book for young people called Malcolm Little, The Boy Who Would Grow Up to Become Malcolm X. It details the fascinating early life of Malcolm X, who was assassinated February 21st, 1965 in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. And Scott Andrew Selby, A Serial Killer in Nazi Berlin, The Chilling True Story of the S-Bahn Murderer. All this, but now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633 and 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we start our week with Rene Orang of Visit Baton Rouge. She and Paul Arrigo are part of the A-team at Visit Baton Rouge. Rene is the Executive Vice President for Sales and Marketing. So how are we looking for this year? Is it going to be a banner year for our city?
2014 is looking very strong, Jim. 2012 was the best year ever in the hospitality industry. Hotel revenue was highest to date. 2013 was about 5% down.
Now, why was 2012 best ever?
Well, I think there were several reasons. One, business travel increased, was back up from pre-recession levels. And we also hosted the United States Bowling Congress, which was 150 days here in town.
Gotcha.
Increased revenue, the overall occupancy about 5%. We also had some overflow from Hurricane Isaac from the North Shore in New Orleans.
So it was down about 5%.
About 5.
And you're anticipating an uptick in 2014?
We are. We're anticipating it to be 2012 levels.
Okay. Which would mean record levels. Well, the downtown area is certainly vibrant, alive, and compare it to a decade ago or two decades ago, and it's been quite a move in the right direction. How did Red Stick Revelry go?
Very well, as a matter of fact. They estimated about 15,000 attendees for the first year. I think that's incredible. We're looking at that being a recurring event.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 297-5633. InksterShow@WRKF.org for Rene Orang of Visit Baton Rouge. And a question from Missy. Is your group going to take a position on the St. George controversy?
You know, our position is that the travelers really don't know boundaries, whether they're counties, parishes, or cities. So we represent the greater Baton Rouge area, and we will continue to do that.
So it could be Visit Baton Rouge, Visit Port Allen, Visit St. George. You're okay with what's a rose by any other name is still a rose?
The Baton Rouge area is the Baton Rouge area.
Okay. But last year was, you say, a good year. Now, that bowling infusion in 2012, that's huge. They're coming back, aren't they?
They are. In 2017, we'll have the women's tournament. In 2025, which seems really far off, we'll have the men's again.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned on this show a few weeks ago something that I had not been aware of until recently, and it's certainly notable that the Baton Rouge Airport is in the same congressional district as the New Orleans Airport. Cedric Richmond represents both airports because of the weird lines that were drawn to represent the congressional districts. There's a big, if you've been out there, big a movement in the right direction with the Baton Rouge Airport. It's looking great.
It is looking great. As a matter of fact, we just finished a partnership with them and doing some new filming to promote Baton Rouge and the airport with InFlight Magazine. So we'll have some great new footage of the expansion.
How do you, do you follow the traffic that goes out there? Are they having the same kind of activity they had, let's say, post-Katrina?
They are at record levels. As a matter of fact, there are probably no more seats to be sold, and that's part of our challenge is getting more seats for the planes to bring people in and out of Baton Rouge.
297-5633 for Rene Orang of Visit Baton Rouge. How long have you been with what is now Visit Baton Rouge?
11 Formally, years.
Speaking of Rose by any other name, 11 years. Mm-hmm. So you've seen particularly the downtown area, grow leaps and bounds.
Absolutely. Baton Rouge as a whole has grown leaps and bounds.
And what does that mean for the overall community?
For the Baton Rouge, for the downtown area to have grown?
Yeah.
Walkability is a huge factor for travelers. They want to be able to go to their hotel room and walk to dinner and walk to shop and walk to entertainment. So that gives them the options of doing that if they like, although you can do that College Drive area as well. So we definitely represent the entire area. Having a vibrant downtown helps all of us, however.
Now, I understand that you and Carl Castle are good friends. Is that correct?
I don't know if we're good friends. I'm certainly a huge fan, and we were lucky enough to host Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me to tape here last fall. And as a matter of fact, I heard a plug for Baton Rouge just this weekend where Mary Madeline, James Carville's wife, was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as a guest host. As you know, James Carville was our guest host.
Yeah, well, James Carville was the guest host, and he is synonymous with Louisiana. Spent many of his years in Baton Rouge. In fact, he notes that he spent, about 16 years here getting 2 degrees at LSU. But Carl Castle was, of course, there, as he is with every presentation of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, along with Peter Siegel. And he is famous for his answering machine messages. Now, were you lucky enough to have one of those messages?
I was lucky enough to get two, as a matter of fact. One for my home, because my
really?
Husband and my son both listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me as well, but I wanted one for my cell phone, which puts people off a little bit, but it's really fun. The one you have, I believe, is the one for the house.
Okay, well, we do have one, and perhaps we'll be able to give it a listen here. And we heard the one he gave to Ann Edelman a few weeks ago, too. And Carl really goes all out on these answering machine messages. Gaston on Perkins. Good morning, Gaston. You're on WRKF with Renee Arang.
Good morning, Jim and Renee. I was just curious because I've heard there's a certain amount of duplicity in this in this office. I don't know. I mean, this is just speculation, but what's the difference between the Visit Baton Rouge and the Downtown Development District, and where do they get their funding from?
Okay, he asked about the funding for Visit Baton Rouge. Where do you get your funding?
Well, we're self-generating, actually. We're funded directly by a tax that is assessed on hotel rooms, so the visitors pay a 3% tax. It's dedicated directly to Visit Baton Rouge. So the more people we bring in, the better we do.
And he asked about duplicity. Are you lean and mean as far as your operations?
Absolutely. We've had a very clean audit every year that I've been there.
Okay. And Visit Baton Rouge does many things. It's involved, for example, with the Baton Rouge Area Sports Foundation, correct?
They are one of our partners in our building, as well as the Baton Rouge Film Commission. So basically, we see ourselves as the marketing arm of Baton Rouge. So whether it's a group, a convention, a travel writer, a leisure traveler, we reach out to all of them.
297-5633 is your number if you'd like to talk with Renee Arang, who is the number two person at Visit Baton Rouge. Now, before the end of the year, we heard from her partner in crime, Paul Arrigo, formerly Paul Arrigo. And we have another question that I'm sure would be near and dear to both of you about the Perkins. Michael, can you, Perkins Road overpass, what is the, I don't know what the question is about the Perkins Road overpass, but there was a big sprucing up there a few years ago, shut down for about a year. What was the involvement, if any, from Visit Baton Rouge?
The development there was strictly commercial, so the laying of sidewalks and all for the area, and then the development of Cadian Village with Trader Joe's and Payway and all that in there.
Well, that's been a help to that particular area. Mm-hmm. It looks spectacular. Galatoire's is in that shopping center now. Even has a Keen's, among other things. Boo Thomas was on the show and said the shopping center there is much better than the one across the street. Aesthetically, how do you view a good development from a not-so-good development?
Well, you know, one of the top three reasons people come to Baton Rouge is to shop. So we definitely put shopping out there as an option and include as many options as we can.
Okay. Paul says, what is the largest tourist draw in the greater Baton Rouge area? And what is the area missing that we need to achieve greater tourism? For example, hotels, convention center, Audubon Alive, etc.
So the top three reasons people come to Baton Rouge are our cuisine, our culture, and shopping. And we've surveyed them many times, and those are always the top three. So we continue to promote, obviously, Baton Rouge as a culinary destination, our historical culture, our social culture, including Mardi Gras and events that don't happen in other areas of the country, as well as all of our shopping opportunities, including the new developments, the mall. We also have a tax-free shopping exchange center here in Baton Rouge now, which is great. So that encourages international shopping as well.
What about football?
Football's huge, and we are a great partner with LSU. We help them promote other sports, obviously baseball, basketball, women's basketball, volleyball, to encourage attendance at those. Top seven weekends of the year are typically home LSU games.
Well, there you go. Now, we mentioned the answering machine, and Michael Farrar is producing today. I think we have a copy of one of the messages that Mr. Carl Castle delivered to Renee Orang. And remember, wait, don't tell me, stopped here to a packed house at the River Center with Peter Sagal and Carl Castle and the whole crew. And along the way, Ann Edelman got an email or a answering machine message from Mr. Castle, and so did Renee Orang. Do we have it, Mike?
You've reached the Orang Gang. Jason, Renee, and Nicholas aren't here right now. They invited me, veteran broadcaster and all-around great guy, Carl Castle, to hang out for a while in case they got a call. It's very comfortable here. Lots of wine and a fridge full of food. I don't even mind watching Mike and Maggie. Since you've called, please leave your message, and I'll pass it along.
That's not bad.
Adorable. Just adorable. What a trooper he is.
Yeah. And you didn't have to bribe him or anything like that to get him to do that?
He didn't. No.
No.
Mike and Maggie, by the way, are our golden retrievers.
Yeah. Now, does Peter Sagal do the same thing, I wonder?
No. I think just Carl Castle.
Just Carl Castle.
Yeah.
He does it well.
He has a great voice, doesn't he?
He does. And the moment you hear that the voice, you know it's Carl Castle, who has been gracious enough to be with us and to be involved with an event specifically for WRKF at the LSU Journalism School. I mentioned football, and of course LSU football and Southern football are big things in this community. How closely do you work with the universities?
Very closely. As a matter of fact, our listeners may know about Bayou Country Superfest. That's one of our partnerships with LSU and Festival Productions to bring that to Tiger Stadium Memorial Day weekend. This year will be three nights. We're very excited about the growth of that event. And, of course, we support and promote all events at LSU.
And you have George Strait. Reba McEntire as well, two of the real legends of country music, or any other kind of music for that matter, and it's three nights, and it's I'm sure going to pack Tiger Stadium. LSU gets a new field out of it every year.
They do.
So it's a win-win. It's a symbiotic relationship, isn't it?
Not only George Strait, we have Luke Bryan, we have Jason Aldean and Eric Church. It's going to be a wonderful weekend. This is the first year that tickets in the highest levels have been sold. So we had restricted that in past years, so we're very excited.
Well, George Strait is heavy duty. He doesn't do a whole lot of these things. He is he'll be 62 on the 18th of May, so he's a guy who his prime has been for a very long time, and I know he has many fans here in this community. It should be the biggest Bayou Country Superfest to date. Do you think that event's going to last indefinitely?
We are counting on it.
Where
it's
you're counting
very
on
successful.
It. Is that a yes or a no?
Well, we don't actually put the event on. It's put on by a private producer, the same producer that puts on the Jazz Festival. We partner with him to market the event and to encourage attendance. We know that it's been very successful. The Baton Rouge hotels have increased their revenue more than 300% since 2009, which was the last year before the festival. So we want it to be here forever.
All right. Well, hope you have a great year, and we look forward to an update sometime very soon. Renee Orang, congratulations on a fine 2013, and best of luck this year. And we shall return after this 90-second pause on 89.3. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Our guest at this time is Ilyasa Shabazz, the daughter of Malcolm X, an activist, motivational speaker, and author of the critically acclaimed Growing Up X. She promotes higher education, interfaith dialogue, and building bridges between cultures for young leaders of the world, and she is the author of another book for young adults called Malcolm Little, the Boy Who Grew Up to Become Malcolm X. Good morning, Ilyasa.
Good morning. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you right now. I actually wish I was there.
Why?
But now, this book, it's a children's. It's an illustration book.
Yeah, I have it. I guess, yeah, it's for anybody, but obviously directed toward younger people, no doubt about
yes.
it.
Yes.
Now, it's about your father, who was killed in 1965. I think he was 39 years old. You were what? One or two at the time?
I wasn't quite three.
Okay, so you were very young.
I was very young.
How much
do I remember about my father?
Yes.
Well, you know, I write about in Growing Up X, basically flickering images and moments spent with him. I remember he had beautiful big teeth. You know, I know that he was really tall. Well, you know, he's 6'5", 6'4", 6'5". And, you know, most of what I know of my father was from my mother and from family, of course, and then, of course, friends. And then as I went to college, I learned, you know, taking classes about the icon Malcolm X. But this book is a children's book, and it focuses more on the values. You know, my father was raised with great parents, and they instilled wonderful values, and it focuses on the childhood of his life.
He was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
He sure was, Midwesterner.
Yeah.
He was born in Omaha, Nebraska, and, you know, his parents, they were activists. I mean, you know, you look at the 1920s and what was happening in our country around then, and there in the Midwest, on land that was reserved for white people. And so they were burned out of, you know, one place. So they moved from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, well, actually Omaha to Milwaukee to East Lansing, or Lansing, and then ultimately to East Lansing.
Well, you note that when he was 4 years old, something horrifying happened that he would never forget. What happened?
That his home was burnt to the ground.
No, that's something that would certainly be in the memory bank for anybody who lived on to no matter how old. And your dad,
right?
Your dad
right,
only lasted
right,
another 35 years before his life was taken. But what effect did that have on him as a young person?
Well, I think it instilled some sense of terror. But his parents, you know, in the children's book, I show how they move to the next home, you know, still with optimism, faith, perseverance. And, you know, those are great values to instill in a child, that no matter what happens to you, you have to keep moving forward and, you know, and not be consumed by that. And it went on to instill his foundation. Now, you know, I can't help but to go to the picture, the page, because A.G. Fort did such a wonderful job at these illustrations. But, you know, there's a picture of his father building a home, and there are no windows. And his son and Malcolm says, you know, Dad, when, you know, how come we don't have windows in our house? And he says, we have the foundation, and as soon as we're able to afford to pay for the glass, we'll, you know, put the glass. You know, so just the security that a father brings to a child, you know, all of that great stuff.
You say, Ilyasa, that Malcolm was influenced profoundly by his father. I'm sure that shaped the man that Malcolm Little would become.
Yes. Well, his father was an activist in the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And, you know, in the 1920s, you know, the social climate wasn't the best for people of color. And his father fought for equality, justice, and he was killed, and Malcolm basically took the baton from his father. Actually, his father was influential in getting Marcus Garvey out of jail for the alleged mail fraud charges in the 1920s. And his mother was the national recording secretary, very educated, learned woman, and she instilled the value and love for education in her children. And so, of course, my father went on to just be this avid reader and also, like his father, fought against injustice, and he circled the globe in the final years of his life searching for solutions for the human condition, which, you know, it really says a great deal for this man. He was only in his 20s when the world learned of Malcolm X, and he was killed at 39 and certainly younger than I am. And, you know, I don't know, you sound like a pretty young man over there, you know. You know, he was just a young man, you know, and he really took on such a, you know, a gigantic responsibility and burden, you know, and never asked for a penny for himself, never compromised his values, you know, by accepting money, you know, for anything other than looking for true solutions for the human condition.
Well, you're right that the young boy, who until now had learned so much from his parents, lost his father, Earl,
yes,
to the brute force of racism and the narrow-mindedness of the Ku Klux Klan members and their brethren in the Black Legion. What happened?
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, in the 1920s, Earl was gathering a petition to take the League of Nations, which was the predecessor organization. Now, this isn't in the children's book, though, because the children's book focuses on...
Right,
you know,
but you do refer to this, though.
Yes, yes. That my grandfather was gathering a petition to take the U.S. up on charges for violating the human rights of the Negroes during that time. And, of course, my father, you know, as an adult, was doing the same thing to address the issues, the social injustice against African Americans. And, you know, the thing is that often we find it difficult to talk about what really happened, you know, that is a part of American history. You know, is it African American history, but isn't African American history a part of American history? So, you know, I think it's important to talk about our history, you know, collectively. These are things that happened with Native Americans, that happened with African Americans. Understanding, you know, that the country, I don't even know why we're talking about, now we're going on to a different subject, but the foundation of this new world as we all know it, you know, mm-hmm. The benefits that all Americans receive, you know, and the Africans cultivating barren land.
Right. Now, how important is it, in your judgment, as the daughter of Malcolm X, one of his, I think, six daughters,
yeah,
that his legacy be remembered, specifically for the young people that you're directing this book to?
Well, you know, I think when you look at who Malcolm was, he was a man of impeccable integrity. And I don't say it because he's my father, but, you know, when you take a step back and look at the social climate and see that this young man of so many millions of people stood up against injustice, you know, when we look at the things that were happening in his lifetime in the 1920s, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, the Jim Crow era, the Great Depression, all of the things that shaped him, and we see that this young man literally stood up, you know, and challenged the status quo, but he challenged injustice. He never did anything. He didn't provoke violence. You know, he didn't provoke anything. He stood up against it. And I often talk to people, you know, one of my best memories or readings of my father is his debate, the Oxford University debate, and he quotes Shakespeare, to be or not to be, whether it is noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing end them. It means standing up and taking responsibility for your country, for your people. If there's injustice, you talk about it. You try to find solutions for these issues. And so that says a great deal about Malcolm, you know. And when studying him, I didn't study him from the perspective of Daddy. I studied him from the perspective of this young man who existed during this time, and I found him to be just absolutely remarkable. And so I receive invitations all around the world because I am his daughter. And one of the things that I find in common, no matter the socioeconomic background, no matter the religion, no matter the ethnic background, no matter the gender, is that every parent wants their child to be lovable, to feel that they are lovable, to be educated, have a quality education, and to be able to ultimately participate in mainstream economy. And so it's no different with, you know, we're all the same. So I just thought that this was a wonderful book for children. It provided a quality time for a parent to read to their child, to address, you know, whether they're feeling ugly, whether they're not feeling smart, whether they're, you know, whatever the issue is, I try to incorporate it in the book and the relationship with his siblings and his mother and his father and what was going on around him. Up until the time he was about 10 years old,
right.
Living in the Great Midwest.
You note that at one point in Malcolm's young life, he was the only student of color in his class. How did he handle that?
Well, he actually grew up. You know, again, they moved so much because the premium land that his father would get was often reserved for white people, so he was always the only child of color in his schools. Up until the time he went to a reform school, or you know, but so it wasn't anything for him, you know. Just as his parents, you know, my mother raised us, you know, with the concept of, you know, we're all brothers and sisters under the fatherhood of God. So it wasn't so much your color or your ethnic background as it was your deeds. I'm not going to hang out with, you know, I wish I was still in my youth. But, I mean, I'm not going to hang out with someone who's doing drugs if I don't, you know, if I don't agree with that. Or I'm not going to hang out with someone who's stealing or who's beating people or who's, you know, my preference is to hang out with people who have the same values that I have rather than hang out with someone who is my complexion. You know?
Right. Now, your mother was a remarkable person. She was left with, what, six daughters under the age of seven when Malcolm was assassinated. I suspect she had a major impact on your development and the development of your siblings.
She certainly did. The reason that I do what I do is because I love my mother. So much. I had a great relationship and just extreme respect and admiration for her. Also, not because she was my mother, but in looking at what she endured, you know, in the 60s, being left with six babies. I mean, she was still pregnant with my youngest twin sisters. She witnessed her husband being harassed and just so many things through a firebomb. You know, their home was firebombed a week prior to his assassination. And, you know, she was still just a young, beautiful woman. And she went back, you know, she was already educated, but she went back and she got her PhD and put us in the best schools that she could. Education was very important. You know, she sent us to the United Nations, International School, all these great schools for quality education. And sent us to Vermont in the summer, you know, just to understand Native American values, Quaker values, swimming, boat, just everything. I don't know how she did it, but she did. And, you know, I often, again, tell young people, that when you have self-respect, when you understand who you are as a person of whatever ethnic group, as a woman, all of these different things that you're able to, and faith in God that you're able to do anything that you put your mind to. And that's what I got from my mother. Just amazing woman. Amazing.
We're visiting with Ilyasa Shabazz. She is the third daughter of Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz. Now, before we part company, I did want to note that you have been a big patron for the arts in New York City, on the board for the Harlem Symphony, involved with the New York City Opera. How important, Ilyasa, do you think artistic endeavors are to young people?
Oh, I think they're very important. You know, I have a love for the arts, and I often say, if I was not Malcolm X's daughter and this was the perfect world, there was no injustice, everyone had equal, you know, education, opportunities, et cetera, that I would, you know, unfortunately I can't sing because I certainly would be, a, you know, an opera singer. I love arts. I think it's a great form of self-expression. You know, it soothes the common beast. It soothes the soul. So I think it's extremely important for young people, for everyone in general. I mean, you know, even in the 50s, in the 60s, when there was this inequities of, you know, so many different things, the one thing that we all had in common is that we could all sit down and listen, whether we were in the back of the bus or, you know, back of the theater or the front, that we all enjoyed music, that we all can look at beautiful renderings, you know, of art, of just all kinds, and just, you know, just love it.
Well, Malcolm X was a man who was one of the most prominent people in the 20th century in the United States. He died at 39 on February 21st, 1965, assassinated in the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. And he left six daughters, a beautiful wife, and quite a legacy, and Ilyasa has recaptured the youth of Malcolm Little, the boy who would grow up to become Malcolm X. It's a new book. Illustrations are quite good from A.G. Ford, as Ilyasa noted. And for those who didn't know, Malcolm X was president of his seventh grade class. Where was that?
You are so super fantastic. That was in the Midwest, let's see, when he was in, Mason Junior High School.
Mason Junior High School.
Yeah, that was in, so it's in the Midwest in, Michigan.
Well, he was a leader at a young age and certainly died much too young. And
yes, absolutely. And, you know, my uncles, they often talked about all the children would love to come to my father's, you know, to their house as they were growing up because they had all of this wooded area.
Hold that thought. We'll be back with Ilyasa Shabazz after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Wrapping it up with Ilyasa Shabazz, the third daughter of Malcolm X. Her book is Malcolm Little, the boy who grew up to become Malcolm X. And as we hit the break, Ilyasa, you were remembering your dad, and I didn't want to cut you short.
Oh, no, that's okay. Well, I was just remembering that my my uncles would often talk about my father, and all the kids would be out in the back, and he would, you know, they were the only black children, so that he would be Robin Hood, and, you know, and everyone would just follow along with whatever he said. So he was always, right, a leader, even as a child.
I suspect you've gotten this question a few times, and I'm forwarding it from a listener, but the relationship between your father and Martin Luther King Jr., was it a complex one?
No, not at all. They actually were fortunate and blessed to meet at right before my father was killed and were going to work together to alleviate the problems that they were both fighting against. So our families grew up very close, the King family and the Shabazz family. My mother and Coretta Scott King were, they were closer than sisters.
Well, the two men died 3 years apart, both at the age of 39. How do you think the world would have been changed if either or both of them had lived a natural life?
I think that we would have, you know, been, you know, my father, my parents, you know, the way they raised Malcolm was that we were all brothers and sisters under the fatherhood of God, and I think that we would understand that more. You know, when you really look at it, we're all, you know, we're all human. We're, you know, there's not much difference, you know, from one and the next. And so I think that it would have been a better understanding of just a human family existence.
Leonard Joseph writes to you, Ilyasa, could you suggest the definitive biography of Malcolm X?
Well, the autobiography of Malcolm X is fairly good. You know, my family is actually releasing some books, but I think that there are some good books out there about my father,
including a few including written by you.
That's right. Right, that's a start. This illustration book is definitely a start. And my website is growingupx.com.
Growingupx.com from Ilyasa Shabazz, beautiful name from an impressive person. And we certainly thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Ilyasa Shabazz. Malcolm Little, The Boy Who Grew Up to Become Malcolm X, is her latest work. Thank you again. Bye. And we're joined now by Scott Andrew Selby, graduate of UC Berkeley and Harvard Law, master's degree in human rights and intellectual property from a university in Sweden, and he is a man who has become a prominent writer in this world of ours, and his latest work is A Serial Killer in Nazi Berlin, the chilling true story of the S-Bahn murderer. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a hard act to follow, Malcolm X's daughter.
Well, you're talking about a topic that is fascinating. What was going on in the midst of the Nazis? There was a serial killer?
Exactly. So this is the very height of Nazi power in the heart of their empire, right inside of Berlin. And there was a blackout because of the war, so you couldn't have any light at all during the night to try to prevent bombers from locating targets. And there's a man who's taking advantage of the chaos of the war and the regime to attack and kill women in a garden area near where he lived, as well as throwing them off of the train at night.
Well, this is a topic, as I stated, that many are unfamiliar with. How did you get immersed in it, Scott?
I was reading actually just a novel about a detective by Philip Kerr that was set in this time period, and it mentioned this story, and the details were so great, I thought this had to be true. I got online, got on Wikipedia, saw that it was true and that nobody had written a book about it, and I was on it.
Well, the serial killer is a gentleman who's, what, he's an employed family man, correct?
Correct. He's an employed family man. On paper, everything looks good. He was a member of the Nazi Party from early on, very Aryan. So he was not the sort of man that the Nazis were suspecting. And from their perspective, unfortunately, they didn't have a lot of their best police officers and detectives. They'd gotten rid of everybody who was, you know, didn't fit their worldview. Everybody who was Jewish, everybody who was liberal, you know, or a socialist. And here in the heart of their empire, they have somebody that's making a mockery of their police state, somebody that's with impunity riding the trains and attacking the women who are taking them late at night to go to their factory jobs to try to keep the war effort afloat.
How many people did this man kill?
It's a good question. In the scheme of things, by the Nazi standards, very few. He killed about eight women and attacked about 12 in total. But the fear that he struck into the hearts of the women of Berlin was tremendous, and the implications ran all the way up to the top leaders, including Hitler spoke of him. Goebbels got involved in trying to manage the investigation. So it was basically the impact and the fear that he had in the city that was trying to deal with the war.
I want to make sure I get this man's pronunciation right. It's Paul, and his last name, Scott, is pronounced?
Ogorzo.
Okay. He is an employed family man, a party member, and a sergeant in the infamous Brown Shirts. Now, we had a serial killer loose here in Baton Rouge a little over a decade ago now, and it turned out that the profile was dead wrong about this man. But the profile of a serial killer that was given at that time was that they usually tend to be young men, white men, smart, loners, a bit eccentric maybe. All of that turned out to be bogus with the guy who was caught, Derek Todd Lee, but would this guy, Ogorzo, would he fit the profile?
He would not fit that profile at all other than white and male. And he certainly didn't fit the notions that the Germans had at the time either, because for them, they thought that it was the other. It was the Jews, the gypsies, the foreigners. But he wasn't. He was a party man. And then their other thought was that they also believed that criminality was inherited. So they would think that you had to be somebody who was somehow not fully human, somebody whose father was a criminal, who grew up a criminal. But he actually was, he's a family man. He had a kid. He had a job. He didn't fit any notions of what they had at all whatsoever. By the way, I looked up those numbers. It was 8 killed and 14 attacked altogether.
Did Hitler know about this?
Yes. Hitler mentioned him, and I have that quote in my book. But this is a little bit below Hitler's pay grade. The main people that were involved were Goebbels, who was in charge of trying to make sure that the Reich looked good. From our perspective, of course, the Nazis are the worst evil ever, pretty much. But from their perspective, they thought that they were building a sort of utopia that would be free of crime. So Goebbels was involved, and he was limiting the amount of information that could be leaked to the public to try to solve this crime. And there also was all sort of infighting between the SS, between the criminal police, and the head detective in this case, William Luttke, actually had barely was able to hold on to his job because before the Nazis came to power, he'd been involved in fighting them and trying to stop some of their street violence and demonstration. But he was one of the few that managed to sort of stick around and he was just trying to do ordinary policing, but it was in the context of a state that itself was criminal, One of the detectives involved in this case went on to kill tens of thousands of people himself. So it was a criminal regime that here is chasing the most ordinary criminals, a serial killer.
The book is A Serial Killer in Nazi Berlin, The Chilling True Story of the S-Bahn Murderers from Scott Andrew Selby. This man, Ogorzo, who were his targets? Were they common in the type of people he was singling out?
Yeah, what he was targeting is German housewives that were left behind. The same thing, to a lesser extent, happened in America, where the men went out to war, and we had Rosie the Riveter telling women to get to the workplace and build, in the factories, all the things that were needed for war. So it was the same thing. Here, most of the men were gone, and the women were working factory jobs. And he was riding around on their commuter train, the S-Bahn, and he was riding in the third-class compartments and waiting until there was some poor woman alone, some housewife whose husband was off at the war, and it just was him and her. And then being in a darkened train, so only one out of four lights up ahead, and the train would be on because of the blackout. And he would wait till just once the train left the station and quickly, without any warning, just attack and then throw the women from the train. But the only real pattern just was they were German, they were women, and they were adults. That was it. It was also sort of dark, so there's a huge age range. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a specific type. It's not like here where sometimes you have a serial killer who only attacks you have blondes or redheads that remind them
of
their mother.
So they didn't just look alike?
It just was targets of opportunity. It was basically just women riding the train. And even though Goebbels wanted to control how much information people had, of course, rumors still existed, and women became afraid to ride the train, which meant that they were afraid to go to the factories, which meant, that it was impeding war manufacturing, potentially. So it was a really a serious issue for them. And this is the time when, because of the blackout, the streets were pitch black. And so crime was considered a huge priority of the state. So if you stole somebody's purse during the day, maybe you got a year in jail. If you steal somebody's purse at night, you get your head cut off. And that's a situation that he was taking advantage of.
So, Scott, he was throwing them from the train? That's how he was killing them?
Yeah, he would just attack them with just pure force. So oftentimes strangulation. He tried using a knife, but found that didn't work. His main thing was hitting him over the head with a piece of telephone cable that the police later recovered. And then right before he started throwing him from the train, because right before he came to a station, he wanted to dispose of evidence, you know, get rid of the victim. And he'd open the train door. It'd be pitch black out. The train would still be moving quickly, and he'd drag him over there and then throw him out. And the first couple victims survived. And with the first one, the police didn't believe her at all, because it made no sense that somebody would just attack her and not steal anything or anything. And the thing that he found is that he enjoyed that process of throwing women that he thought were dead or unconscious off of the train. He found that something that he'd done just as a way of sort of not getting caught was the thing that he actually enjoyed the most.
How did he get caught?
Well, that's a good question. maybe if you're afraid of finding out the ending, you should, not hear this. But basically what it was is that the police did everything. I mean, the investigation was massive. They combed these trains with thousands of officers. They had women decoys. Eventually they had German men in drag trying to catch him. They had some false leads. And in the end, it was one of his coworkers who mentioned, they interviewed everybody that worked for the train, and he worked for the train. And one of his coworkers mentioned that he would leave sometimes, that he would just sneak and leave his post, which basically blew his alibi. And so they brought him in, and it was kind of one question led to another. There was a very intense back and forth interrogation between the lead detective and Gorgorzo, in which the lead detective was kind of able to back him into a corner and figure out that this was really their man.
And of course, what happens to Gorgorzo after this is interesting and detailed by Scott Andrew Selby in A Serial Killer in Nazi Berlin. You know, there are some folks who believe that serial killers only were active in the United States, but this proves that's not always been true.
Yeah, that's certainly not the case. I mean, this guy was active in Nazi Berlin, right, at the height of all of their power. And I'd written about Nazi Berlin before. I wrote something called The Axeman Conspiracy about some Nazis at the end of the war that tried to bring back the Reich. And I've dealt with some of these sorts of issues with my first book, Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. And, crime exists everywhere, and serial killing just is a variety of crime, you know?
Mm-hmm. Why do you think there's this fascination? I think there's a film about to be released about Nazi Germany. Why is there this continuing fascination about that time and that place?
I mean, they're pretty much the worst guys in history. I mean, you can make an argument for some other groups, that have killed a lot of people, like Pol Pot or Stalin or, some others. But, I mean, the Nazis are, it's an era of good guys versus bad guys. And, we were the good guys. America went in there and we freed Europe. And, and it was a criminal regime. They were colorful, they were charismatic, and they were just basically villains out of an old school movie. There's something about that's really refreshing in this world of, of very complicated conflicts that are sometimes hard to understand and it's hard to know if you've won or not when a village keeps changing hands. And, here's something when there's massive forces at work. And there's just something about the story that's very intriguing. I think will continue to be intriguing. And there's a reason that, we call the people that fought on our side the Greatest Generation. They stormed the beach of the D-Day, which is an incredibly brave thing to do. There's, Fortress Europe. They had to, get in there and basically they saved the world, We America saved the world along with our allies.
We're short on time, Scott. But Heather asks, what did Gorgorzo look like?
he looks like an incredibly ordinary guy. He's you can see his picture on the cover of the book. It's on Amazon or go to aserialkiller.com. But basically, he had a broken nose. It was his only distinguishing feature, and somehow none of the eyewitnesses or victims noticed that. So I as a lawyer, I talk a bit about, you know, the problems with eyewitness identification, which still plague us even today.
Well, the book is A Serial Killer in Nazi Berlin, The Chilling True Story of the S-Bahn Murderer. It's from our guest, Scott Andrew Selby. Thank you, Scott. Good luck, and appreciate
you
sharing your story. And we shall return tomorrow. For Michael Farrar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at wrkf.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.